On FM, Penny Downey continues reading A Long Walk Home, Judith Tebbutt's account of her 192-day ordeal at the hands of Somali pirates. In today's episode, after months in captivity and still struggling with the news that her husband was killed on the night of the kidnapping, Judith begins to fear for her own sanity.
Surveying the room was a stern test of my spirits from the moment I opened my eyes to see a gauzy mesh of grey cobwebs on the ceiling above me. Continual noises and small rustlings made me start, and when I began to see insects emerging through the walls, I recoiled and wondered if I could believe my eyes. The floor was 9 paces long, and my challenge hadn't changed: to walk that floor a dozen times daily until I fell into bed from weariness. Lying on a filthy floor shared with cockroaches in order to peek out under a curtain was a debasing activity, but I decided it was not so bad in return for at least seeing what was on the outside, even just my captors on their mats. I found myself strangely isolated here, so took to virtual driving, beginning by picturing myself clambering into our car on the drive at Bishop Stortford. I could feel and smell the leather seats, the steering wheel in my hand. I routinely headed for Cumbria, towards the M11, then A14, M6, A509. In this horrible house, I soon got used to waking up in the morning and discovering different, if familiar, faces in my room and in the yard outside. Clearly, the pirates were rotating my guard, and I suppose they were hardly more comfortable with this squalid setting than I was. None of the pirates ever seemed to refer to each other by name. When the navigator looked in on me one afternoon, I asked, "What is your name?" He looked at me warily, then whispered, "Ali." "Ali, I see. And what is your second name?" He whispered again, "Mohammed, after my father." I'd really like to know the names of the other pirates. How do I ask them what their name is in Somali? "In Somali, what is your name is Makaha." "Right, and if I wanted to say, my name is Jude, what is your name?" "Magahagua, Jude Makaha." This seemed to me quite a breakthrough, and it was underlined when Ali took it upon himself to name for me one or two other members of the group. There were multiple ways in which I could keep my mind keen. My body, however, seemed to me less and less manageable. I stank, felt horrible. My feet were blistered and bloodied from walking, and by the end of each day had swollen, freakishly so. As my hair began to come out in handfuls, my fears heightened, and there wasn't an ounce of fat on me. My hip bones jutted out, and I could feel my sternum and ribs. My body was subsisting on itself. Monday, the 19th of December 2011, was, by my reckoning, my 100th day in captivity. A gloomy milestone, compounded by the knowledge that I hadn't seen the negotiator for quite some time. And then, returning from the toilets, I saw him by chance. His expression was dark. 300, he shouted at me. "Your son say 300, not enough." I retreated to my room, and a little later he entered with a fat man and announced, "This man is getting tired, he get no money. It make him very upset, very angry. He could decide to sell you to another pirate group. You know, in Somalia, anything can happen. You understand? This man can make you disappear." I felt as if I was being assaulted, that they were determined to drive me to submission. "So you must think," the negotiator said, "how you can get us more money." "What if I can't?" I blurted. "Has it crossed your mind that whatever Ollie's offered is as much as he can get?" The negotiator stood calmly. "Big man say, if that's that, then we're done with you. We shoot you." And he followed the fat man out of the door. I couldn't stop it. I lost all control of my thoughts. In my head, I saw them shoving me against a wall, pushing my blindfolded head into the dirt, a rifle cocked and fired. I stumbled backwards, hugged my knees as the darkness came down. Gradually, in the gloom, I could make out a figure on the floor, a person lying prone, but not alone. From the shadows emerged a committee of scavengers, ball-headed, sharp-beaked birds, vultures, and I could see the stricken figure was wearing my pink-silver jilbab, because the figure was me. A frail hand reached out to me for help, and there was nothing I could do. Clarity of mind returned slowly in patches, and I told myself urgently, they won't shoot you. You can't let your imagination take control. That's how you lose your mind, and then you're gone forever. One afternoon in January, the radio brought dramatic news. Two foreign aid workers kidnapped by Somali pirates 3 months earlier, an American woman, Jessica Buchanan, and a Danish man by the name of Paul Hyentista, had been sprung from captivity following a raid by US Navy SEALs. 9 Somali pirates had been killed. It was clear to me that something about the rescue of Jessica Buchanan, not least the swift and startling manner of its execution, had rattled the pirates. "Big man, fed up," said Ali. "He fed up of paying for you to be here. Ali must get money." That was disconcerting. I had been on the sparsest rations for so long, I was slowly wasting away. But my fears of a new austerity were quickly borne out. I was served 1 meal a day, an evening meal, of which I immediately learned to save a little for the following morning. These were starvation measures. Then, one evening, I felt cramps in my stomach. I was still weeping, curled in a fetal position, when Ali entered. And he returned later with a white capsule. It had no effect. For the next day I was gripped with pain, my stomach rock hard. On the third day, I told Ali I had to be taken to hospital. I really feared for how bad I was and how much worse I might get. Hospital was, I guessed, not an option, but this time I received 2 sets of tablets with pharmacy-written instructions on a piece of paper. I actually believed these pills would work. And they did. The radio continued to offer me certain markers, things to aim for. Increasing attention was being paid to the London Olympics in the build-up to the July opening, and I kept telling myself, if I was home to see the games, then I would count it a blessing. I found myself listening to a World Service report on the state of Somalia, and the announcement of a special conference to be held in London later that month, hosted by David Cameron. I heard that Foreign Secretary William Hague described Somalia as the world's worst failed state. The programme recited the litany of crisis conditions besetting Somalia. People in poverty, swathes of the country controlled by extremists, prospering pockets of criminality and terrorism. The show rehearsed an explanation, if not a justification, for the upsurge in Somali piracy, how, after the collapse of governance in 1992, its coastline became a plundering zone for big foreign fishing trawlers chasing tuna, lobster, shark and shrimp, and dealing a massive blow to the staple of the local economy. Some angry Somali fishermen took to launching defensive sorties against these trawlers. Soon, they realised, that to board a foreign ship and hold its crew hostage could yield a ransom. The idea caught fire, and now the navies of many foreign nations patrolled the coast of Somalia while their commercial trawlers employed armed guards. The pirates' focus had turned towards softer targets, foreign tourists, like David and me. One contributor, an expert on hostage situations, volunteered that the average duration of captivity for a hostage in Somalia was roughly 8 months. I had survived 5 months now. Another 3 felt doable. But any longer than that, another 7, making a year, felt like agony. I smelled the negotiator before I saw him when he paid his first visit to me beyond the walls of the big house. He entered my room with a full cohort of pirates at his back.
"You very thin,"
he said, gesturing towards my bony arms. "I know," I replied. "That's because I'm not eating properly." That evening, I thought I could make out a double tablespoon's worth of rice in my dish. In the morning, likewise, I seemed to have been served twice as much greyish potato. I wondered if they hadn't made a decision to feed me up a bit. Did I dare to think that wheels were turning? The Friday of that week, the 16th of March, the negotiator called on me once again, becoming, by his own standards, a regular visitor.
"I need to take a video of you," the negotiator said.
"What for?" I asked.
"For the people who gonna take you to airport."
I took my headscarf off, and he wrote down what I was to say on a piece of paper. I was filmed against the wall with its lime green banded curtains patterned with tulips. The atmosphere was nearly jovial. Maybe this is it, I thought. Maybe I am going. "I am Jude Tebbutt. I have been well looked after. I have been fed. I've not been tortured. I've had medical treatment. I have slept well. I have not been harmed. I've had water." I'd been told several times before about my imminent release, only for it to have turned out as nothing but a tactic for keeping me under control. But over that weekend, the atmosphere in the compound changed utterly. The negotiator turned up in my room on Sunday with a triumphant look in his eye.
21! 21!
He shouted. Today was the 18th of March. Could release be just 72 hours away? Then Ali asked for my book and pen, and I watched as he carefully inscribed a phone number and email address on the page.
"When you go home," he said, "please ring me, text me, Blue Room Hotel. Then I know you're home."
I nodded, having no such intention.
"When you see Ollie," he said, smiling, "you say, 'Hello, from Ali. I like to see London. If I come to London, you take me out.'"
"I don't think so," was the reply I settled on after a moment of careful consideration. The negotiator came again on Monday and told me I would talk to Ollie. I had endured 3 months without a call.
"Mum, we've been told you'll be released tomorrow. You're going to be taken to an airport, and a plane is coming to get you, a small plane, and on it is a man who will tell you his name is Jack. You can trust this man, Mum. Get in the plane, and he will bring you to me, in Nairobi."
That Ollie was in Nairobi made my deliverance seem stunningly close at hand. The details he gave were so precise, so long wished for, that I almost had to catch my breath.
"Right. So, with a bit of luck, I'll see you tomorrow. We'll be together."
Those simple, familiar words, "see you tomorrow," had never been so full of promise.
Penny Downey continues reading A Long Walk Home by Judith Tebbutt tomorrow. The abridger was Miranda Davis, the producer, Justine Willett. International Family Planning and Kate Nash sings in Woman's Hour in a couple of minutes. Looking ahead on Radio 4 Extra.
They come for her later that morning. A car. Footsteps on the path.
Joan Stanley has a secret.
The knock comes 5 seconds later, as she knew it would.
An elderly woman's past catches up with her in next week's Book at Beach Time.
Open up, security services.
Espionage, pre-war passion, and challenged loyalty.
She knows she should not keep them waiting, and yet she does, just for a moment.
Red Joan starts on Monday afternoon at 2:30 on BBC Radio 4 Extra.